So let me, I have been wrestling. I know we've been working through the book of Revelation. The few times I've preached on the book of Revelation in the past, I've noticed that Satan doesn't like it and really attacks believers. It's kind of like, oh, you want to preach about me? You want to share my ultimate doom? I'm still powerful, and you're going to hurt. This has happened before, so lots of people are getting worked over by the enemy. It's going to get very complex from chapter 14 to chapter 19. Those five chapters are very, very complex. And I probably am going to skim through those chapters. There's a couple reasons. One is lots of new people are going to start attending our church from September, October, November, and so forth. It's going to be very difficult for them to show up in our church, and I'm in the midst of the beast riding the creature. You know, I don't think it will be good for the new people coming in to suddenly delve into the second half of Revelation. So I'm going to probably, again, summarize it quicker, and we're going to get to the end in heaven and the millennium, which they can come in on that. They won't need to understand the whole first part of Revelation to catch the end. So just kind of warning you, we are going to zoom through the next chapters a little bit quicker. So this morning, who is the Antichrist? I want you to turn in your Bibles to Matthew 13. We've been going over who's the Antichrist. The Antichrist in the book of Revelation is called what, by the way? He's not called the Antichrist in the book of Revelation. He's called the Beast. He's referred to as the Beast. The Antichrist, you know, is Satan's man. There's the Anti-Trinity. There's Satan. He's the Anti-Father. There's the Antichrist. He's Anti-Jesus. And there's the false prophet, and he's the Anti-Spirit. The Antichrist likes to swear and curse at God, at his name, heaven, and those who dwell in heaven, and he goes after all the believers. People who become believers during the tribulation and puts them to death. The Antichrist, by the way, has like a what seems to be a fatal wound, but miraculously is healed. But how is he injured? By sword. Does everyone remember that? That's in Revelation 13. He's injured with the sword. So I want you to tuck that in the back of your mind. So who is the Antichrist? Bible scholars believe, and I'm just going to skip right to it, that it is Judas Iscariot. If you got your paper and pen, you can write this stuff down as I go through and show you why lots of people believe it is going to be Judas. I am 60% convinced. I am 40% not convinced, okay? Is everyone with me? I'm not going to die on this. I think it's quite fascinating, and lots of good Bible scholars hold to this, and even when it's explained to others who have never heard of this, 80% of the time they go, you know what, those are very, very good arguments. I am perhaps persuaded. How many of you get the daily bread? Okay, daily bread we give out at the church here. M.R. Dehan is the founder and the editor. I don't know if he's around yet or not, but he promotes that it is Judas Iscariot who is the Antichrist. I thought that's the one that you would most likely know, though many others believe it is Judas Iscariot. So let's put the information together. Hold off on going, well, no way, or yeah, okay. Hold off until the end of the sermon. Okay, you with me? As we put our pieces together. So I want to start in Matthew 13 because I want to start with some thoughts on Judas. And whether it's Judas or not, you're going to learn some interesting stuff, okay? Matthew 13, and I want to start with the parable of the weeds, or in some versions it's called the parable of the tares. We're going to jump to verse 24, Matthew 13, verse 24. Jesus told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while everyone was sleeping, his enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and went away. When the wheat sprouted and formed heads, then the weeds also appeared. The owner's servants came to him and said, "Sir, didn't you sow good seed in your field? Where then did the weeds come from?" "An enemy did this," he replied. The servants asked him, "Do you want us to go and pull them up?" "No," he answered, "because while you are pulling the weeds, you may root up the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest. At that time, I will tell the harvesters, first collect the weeds and tie them in bundles to be burned, then gather the wheat and bring it into my barn." Verse 36, Jesus gives the explanation, which we can kind of all figure out anyway. But here's the explanation to the weeds in the field or the tares. Verse 37. He answered, "The one who sowed the good seed is the Son of Man." So that's Jesus, and he's giving out good seed, the gospel. Verse 38, "The field is the world, and the good seed stands for the sons of the kingdom." So the good seed, the wheat, is all the people, the men and women that give their heart to Jesus Christ. The weeds are the sons of the evil one. And the enemy who sows them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the harvesters are angels. As the weeds are pulled up and burned in the fire, so it will be at the end of the age. Satan likes to plant weeds and tares, especially in God's fields, in God's ministry and work. So I've noticed when I was in the district that Satan likes to plant people in churches, in different ministries that are actually a tare or a wheat, someone from the enemy, that is there to destroy that ministry. However, they're very carefully disguised. So in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, 13, the Apostle Paul writes, and he says, and he's talking about these tares and these weeds, he says, "For such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen. They're masquerading as," what? "Apostles of Christ." They're not true believers. They're actually deceitful. They're putting on a Halloween mask. And no wonder, for Satan himself masquerades as an angel of light. The very next verse says that Satan's messengers, he says you shouldn't be surprised that Satan's messengers masquerade as servants of righteousness. So Satan has this scheme, and he plants people, tares, weeds, in churches and ministries. Their ultimate aim is to destroy that church or ministry or work. Now, Jesus comes along, and Satan has been trying to kill, to eliminate Jesus since he heard the prophecy back in Genesis that a Messiah would come that would crush his head. So all through church, all through history, through the Old Testament and into the Gospels, Satan is like, "All right, there's going to be some Messiah that is going to come that is going to try to kill me, to destroy me, to crush my head. But I am going to try to stop this. I am going to try to undo what God has planned because I want to take over the universe." And so Satan is trying to constantly destroy the Jewish people, destroy the godly seed line, to destroy Jesus when he's born. Satan doesn't know how this Messiah is going to kill him. I don't think Satan understands the cross, but he knows he's got to do something about this Jesus. So now Jesus is doing his ministry, and Jesus decides, "I'm going to put a cabinet together of 12 men. I'm going to call them apostles. They're going to be my cabinet. They're going to be my closest disciples. I'm going to reveal all my truths to these 12 men. And Satan says, this would be a great opportunity to infiltrate that 12 with one of my men, with someone who belongs to me, so that I can get the inner scoop of what is going to go on. What does Jesus have in mind that he's going to do me in? Now, I want you to understand something. If you're going to infiltrate the cabinet member of Putin in Russia, do you send in an inexperienced spy, or do you send in the very best that you have? If you're going to infiltrate North Korea's cabinet with Kim Jong's whatever, are you going to send someone without too much experience, or do you want to send in your very best person to fool that he gets in close to Kim Jong? Well, what's the answer? You send in your best. So Satan says, okay, I need to send in a false apostle, a deceitful workman, someone who's going to masquerade as seemingly a follower of Jesus. It's got to be someone who is the very best to infiltrate the 12. Now, you know, Jesus says, the apostle said, should we pull up the weeds? And what does Jesus say to do? Leave it alone. Leave it alone because you might pull up some wheat. So the question is, let's talk about Judas for a second, and let's talk about his relationship to Satan. So here's what we read in Luke chapter 22. Now the festival of unleavened bread, called the Passover, was approaching, and the chief priests and the teachers of the law were looking for some way to get rid of Jesus, for they were afraid of the people. Then Satan, what? Entered Judas, called Iscariot, one of the 12. And Judas went to the chief priests and the officers of the temple guard and discussed with them how he might betray Jesus. And later on at the Last Supper, when Jesus hands Judas the bread, Satan enters him a second time. Do you know, in all of the Bible that covers thousands of years, there is only one person who was literally filled with the devil. And who do you think that was? Judas. Judas, I mean, there's lots of people that are demon-possessed, but there's only one man who has so surrendered to the enemy that the devil possesses him and fills him, okay? Did Jesus know that Judas was a fake, was a tare, was a weed, was planted? This is John chapter 6. This is actually pretty early on in the ministry of Jesus. And the answer, of course, is yes, Jesus knew Judas was a spy, was a plant. I want you to know that the other apostles had no idea. They had no idea. Judas was so good at disguising himself as a false apostle that the other apostles never suspected him. Even at the Last Supper, when Jesus goes, one of you is going to betray me, do they all go, hey, we know it's Judas. We've seen him. What do all the apostles do? Is it me? Am I the one? Not. And finally, Peter and John, Peter's like, hey, ask Jesus who it is. They have no idea. That's how good Judas is. Even though in John, we learn that this is after the fact that Judas would steal money and stuff like that, sold out. So even the apostles had no idea who it was until Jesus literally told them. But in the beginning of Jesus' ministry, Jesus said, have I not chosen you, the 12? Yet one of you is a devil. Now, he doesn't tell them at that point. It's interesting that Jesus practices the very thing that he tells us to do, which is even if you figure out who the tare is, don't throw them out. Because people will be led astray who will think that this tare is a godly person. And they'll fall away if you try to throw them out. And Jesus, even though he knew it was Judas right from the beginning, he didn't throw him out. Because maybe the other apostles would have been, oh, how could you do that, Jesus? Judas seems to be such a nice person, such a wonderful guy. You with me? Even Jesus practiced, no. I'm not going to throw him out. God will take care of the situation. By the way, in the Greek, it doesn't say, yet one of you is a devil. In the Greek, it says, one of you is a devil. One of you is the devil. In other words, there's a sign, the way Jesus says it, it's like one of you is so close, so filled with the devil that you're like the devil himself, okay? He meant Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot, who, though one of the 12, was later to betray him. This is John chapter 17. This is the section where Jesus is praying in the Garden of Gethsemane. And he's going to pray about the 12 apostles. And here's what he says. He's praying to the Father. And Jesus goes, while I was with them, I protected them and kept them safe by that name, Jesus, you gave me. None has been lost. None of the disciples, the apostles, has been lost except the one doomed to destruction so that scripture would be fulfilled. Who's the one that wasn't saved? Judas Iscariot. Now, in the NIV, I'm going to just tell you right up front, my wife and I, driving back for 9 hours, we were in Massachusetts, and we were driving back, and we are researching in the car for hours the Greek, and I'm very disappointed in the NIV. In the NIV, they put except the one doomed to destruction. In the Greek, it says son of perdition. That's what I have down below there. Perdition can be hell. Yes, it can be destruction. But it misses, I think the NIV going doomed to destruction isn't as accurate as I think it could be, which is in the Greek, it's literally son of perdition. So if you have a New American Standard, which tends to translate, even though the translation's more choppy, they tend to translate the Greek directly into the English, or you have a King James Version, or many other versions, they will put in son of perdition. So I guarded them, and not one of them perished, but the son of perdition, the son of hell. King James Version, none of them is lost, but the son of perdition, the son of hell. Now, the way it's written in the Greek, just so you understand, it actually looks like and could be the title of a person. So it's as if Jesus is giving a title to Judas, and your title is the son of hell, the son of perdition. And in fact, some versions, I just picked out one version, you understand there's about 50 English versions, but some of the versions, because they believe it is a title, will capitalize it. So this is the Aramaic Bible in plain English. I have kept those whom you gave me, and no man among them has perished except. And they capitalize it because they believe in the Greek, and it can be. There's good evidence that it's a title given. He's called the son of perdition. Of course, they're going, instead of perdition, they're going with destruction. But they're capitalizing it because it's a title. So just like Jesus is, in a sense, we could say, he's the son of God, he's the son of heaven, Judas has a title, the son of hell. Like he's almost like the son of Satan. He has such a close relationship. That title, those words, son of perdition, are only used 2 times in the whole Bible. That title, that phrase. The first time, of course, is right here. The second time it is used is in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, all of chapter 2, is about the Antichrist. In verse 3, the Apostle Paul writes, "Don't let anyone deceive you in any way, for that day will not come." That's the beginning of the tribulation is the day. "That day will not come until the rebellion occurs and the man of lawlessness," which is the Antichrist, "is revealed." Now again, this is the NIV. "The man doomed to destruction." But again, in the other versions, almost all the other versions, will have "the son of perdition" or "the son of destruction." So I want you to understand that this title is only used 2 times in the Bible, 1 time of Judas Iscariot, and 1 time of the Antichrist himself. They both have exactly the same title, the son of hell. I mean, you have to make a decision, and scholars are divided. You know, a lot of scholars go, well, Jesus, God's word, just gives 2 separate individuals the same title. Or perhaps it is one and the same individual, the son of hell, that gets that title. Come to Zechariah chapter 11. And that revelation we're going to skip because you already are aware. Those are the verses that the Antichrist is wounded with a sword. So I want you to come to Zechariah. It's the second from the last book of the Old Testament. So you got Zechariah, then you got Malachi, and then you got Matthew. So come to Zechariah chapter 11. Zechariah chapter 11. So this is an interesting chapter on prophecy. And in the NIV, they put a heading. The heading's not actually there in the original Hebrew, but do you have a heading before verse 4? What does it say? 2 shepherds. It's discussing either 2 shepherds or 1 shepherd that appears both times. But this is very prophetic of the into the future, okay? So let's look at shepherd number 1, and I'm just going to jump into verse 10 because we're getting tight here on time. So come to verse 10. This is going to be one of the first shepherds. This is prophetic into the future. "Then I took my staff called favor and broke it, revoking the covenant I had made with all the nations," which is kind of interesting because it reminds you of the Antichrist that makes a covenant for 7 years and then breaks it in the middle. "So I took my staff called favor, broke it, revoking the covenant I had made with all the nations. It was revoked on that day, and so the afflicted of the flock who were watching me knew it was the word of the Lord. I told them, 'If you think it best, give me my pay. But if not, keep it.' So they paid me 30 pieces of silver." That is quoted. That's a prophecy. Who got paid 30 pieces of silver? Judas. And it's what's interesting in this is we get a little bit more of the conversation. And it says when Judas went to betray Jesus and they agreed to the 30 pieces of silver, you understand this says you decide. Give me my pay, but if not, keep it. You decide. I am betraying Jesus because you understand Satan thought by betraying Jesus and having Jesus put to death on the cross that Satan would win. Does everyone understand that? When Satan puts Jesus on the cross, he thought he won. I have crucified the Son of God. I have put him to death and he is in hell. He's going to be mine. He just didn't know about the resurrection. So Judas was like, it doesn't matter. Whether you pay me 30 pieces of silver or not, I'm betraying him because I work for Satan and we want him dead. Then it goes verse 13. "And the Lord said to me, 'Throw it to the potter, the handsome price at which they priced me.'" That's the Lord Jesus is talking. "That's what you priced me, 30 pieces of silver. And what should you do with it?" Throw it to who? The potter. "So I took the 30 pieces of silver and threw them into" where? The house of the Lord to the potter. So when Judas gets paid the 30 pieces of silver, we know this in the Gospels, then he takes the 30 pieces of silver and he throws them into the temple. The chief priests and the Pharisees go, whoa, that's blood money. What do they do with the 30 pieces of silver Judas throws into the temple? They go by a potter's field to bury people that were foreigners. So you understand that whole first part of Zechariah is all prophetic about Judas Iscariot. What a rotten person he was, selling out the Lord for 30 pieces, selling him out even if they didn't pay him, because he's a false apostle. So then, all of a sudden, in verse 14, this is where you have to decide, is this a whole new shepherd, or is this just the same shepherd? So verse 14, then I broke my second staff called union, breaking the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. Then the Lord said to me, take again the equipment of a foolish shepherd, for I'm going to raise up a shepherd. Now, almost every commentary believes this is about the Antichrist. I'm going to raise up a shepherd over the land who will not care for the lost or seek the young or heal the injured or feed the healthy, but will eat the meat of the choice sheep, tearing off their hoofs. That's the Antichrist. He isn't going to care for the believers. That's why he's a beast. He is going to eat believers for dinner. The Antichrist is going to kill believers. Verse 17, here's a prophetic word. Again, almost all commentaries believe this is the Antichrist. Woe to the worthless shepherd who deserts the flock. May the sword strike his arm and his right eye. May his arm be completely withered, his right eye totally blinded. We believe this is a verse about the Antichrist. How is the shepherd wounded? The Antichrist wounded with what? A sword that strikes through his head, blinds his eye, and slices his right arm that it withers. It's a fatal wound, as it says in Revelation. One of his heads was wounded, and he's hit with a sword. We believe this is what happens. Someone comes at the Antichrist with a sword, chops his head and his arm, and everyone thinks he's dead. But he isn't dead. He is still alive. The only question that the Bible scholars have, they realize the first part is about Judas, and they realize the second part is about the Antichrist. The only question is it two different individuals, or is it a prophecy of one and the same individual or person? Does everyone understand that? All right, come to Revelation. Come to Revelation chapter 9. Revelation chapter 9. This is a quick review. In Revelation chapter 9, do you remember about the abyss that Satan opens up to release demonic locusts from? So Revelation chapter 9. Let's read real quick here. This is review. The fifth angel sounded his trumpet, and I saw a star that had fallen from the sky to the earth. That is Satan. He's identified over in verse 11. He's the king over them, the angel of the abyss, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon, and in Greek, Apollyon, which means destruction, destroyer. It is Satan. The star was given the key to the shaft of the what? Abyss. Is abyss capitalized in your version? Okay, because it's the abyss of hell. It's a specific place. The abyss of hell. Verse 2, when he opened the abyss, smoke rose from it like the smoke from a gigantic furnace. The sun and sky were darkened by the smoke from the abyss. And out of the smoke, locusts came down upon the earth and were given power like that of scorpions of the earth. They were told not to harm the grass of the earth or any plant or tree, but only those people who did not have the seal of God on their foreheads. They were not given power to kill them, but only to torture them for 5 months. Do you remember that? That's the demonic demon locusts that are in hell, but Satan is given a key to unlock, and they come out of the abyss to attack those who are not believers. Everyone remember that? Okay. What I didn't tell you is something else comes out of the abyss as well. So come to chapter 11. I skimmed over this because I knew we'd come back to this eventually. In chapter 11 are the two witnesses. Remember, the two witnesses are prophesying for 3.5 years. And, you know, I, of course, believe the two witnesses are Moses and Elijah. But whatever, you got the two witnesses. Who kills the two witnesses? The Antichrist. So let's look at the two witnesses. Verse 7 of Revelation 11, verse 7. Now, when they had finished their testimony, the two witnesses, the beast, that's the Antichrist, this is the part I left out, that comes up from, where does he come from? The abyss will attack them and overpower and kill them. So the Antichrist, his origins is from the abyss, from hell. By the way, did I tell you that Judas was called by Jesus himself the son of hell, the son of perdition? Did I tell you that the Antichrist is called the son of hell, the son of perdition? So the Antichrist comes up out of hell and then kills the two witnesses. So now come to Revelation chapter 17, verse 8. And take a look at this. 17, verse 8. The beast, that's the Antichrist, the beast which you saw once was, now is not, and will come up out of the abyss and then go to its destruction. The Antichrist once was. He once lived on the earth. Now is not. Then will come up out of hell, out of the abyss, and then he will go to his destruction. Of course, at the end of the tribulation, the Antichrist is thrown into the lake of fire. The inhabitants of the earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the creation of the world, will be astonished when they see the beast, because he once was, now is not, and yet will come. There's another section that I don't have time, so during the break, if you're interested, I'll give you another piece of information from the Psalms and the book of Acts that also lends towards Judas Iscariot being the one. Some theologians follow exactly the same reasoning I just did with you, except they believe it's Nero, that it is Nero that will come out. Other people believe it is Nimrod. Almost all scholars believe whoever this is coming from the past, out of hell, back. The only question is, who is it? The reason many scholars go towards Judas Iscariot is because he's the ultimate in the false apostle. He is the one who was filled by the devil. He's so one, so connected. Just like the Father and the Son are one, Judas and the devil are one. They're like Father and Son. And just as Jesus, you know, is coming back from heaven, Judas comes back from hell. That's why he has the title Son of Hell, because he's going to come from hell. He is the son of hell. He's the son of the devil, so to speak. So here's how I plan to close. I believe that Satan does plant tares in churches, because I have seen, working in the district, I have seen how Satan will raise up a person to destroy that pastor and that ministry of that church. But you never know. You don't know who the tares are. You have no idea. Just like the 11 apostles had no idea it was Judas until it was all over. Then they figured it out. And I personally don't know of anyone that is a tear in this church. I don't have any, so I would not know. But I still believe that Satan does exactly what he did with Jesus with every church and ministry in the world. So I guess my message to any tares here this morning is I do believe you can repent and you can get saved. I know you believe that Satan will win and you're on his team. But I wish I could just appeal to you that he is not going to win, that God is going to win, and you're going to lose, and you don't have to go to hell. And so for tares, I plead with you to give your heart to Jesus. I think even Jesus warned Judas. I think he gave him opportunities. I think he was like, Judas, you can change. Judas did not. But I think Jesus gave opportunity. So let's stand. Let's close.